The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast by ExchangeWire. Today I am joined by ExchangeWire CEO, again, Rachel Smith. Hello.
Hi, it's a privilege to be on the podcast 2 weeks in a row.
Yeah, this is unheard of for both of us. It's great. And our very special guest today is Ranga Somanathan, who is CEO of Publicis Media Malaysia. Ranga, lovely to have you. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Lindsay. And hi, Rachel. Good to see you again. It's lovely to be here chatting with you on the eve of the Formula One in Singapore.
Yes, we've just had a very exciting pre-chat with Ranga about F1 in Singapore. It's making me want to be there.
Yeah, me too. I'm very jealous that your office is basically have front row seats to the Singaporean F1, which is amazing. So I shouldn't have said that now because all the people from other markets will try and come over so they can see it. Oops. Sorry, Ranga.
But more than welcome. More than welcome.
Anyway, I will kick off with our first story, which comes out of Marketech APAC. And the Ministry of Digital Development and Information in Singapore has announced the Elections Bill, which seeks to introduce new legal measures to uphold the integrity of online advertising, as well as safeguard the integrity and truthfulness of representation during elections. It was introduced to the Singapore Parliament in September, and according to the MDDI, it seeks to introduce new measures to protect Singaporeans from digitally manipulated content during elections, including AI-generated misinformation, commonly known as deepfakes. This is apparently a worrying trend in Singapore, and this bill deals specifically with deepfakes that misrepresent candidates during the election. On top of this, the Infocom Media Development Authority, the IMDA, will introduce a new code of practice requiring certain social media platforms to put measures in place to prevent and counter the abuse of digitally manipulated content on said platforms. So, Ranga, I'm going to come to you first on this story. This is an interesting bill because it's specifically targeting AI-generated content, so deepfakes. Is this bill needed specifically around the election time? Like, how pressing is its introduction?
I think it is pretty critical that this bill is brought to play and with elections coming around. And 2024 also saw a lot of elections in this part of the world. And we saw how deepfakes were coming in and, muddling up a truth from, fake news. And having this coming in is important. It's not as if there is no law on advertising and messaging during elections. There are already strict rules on how candidates and businesses behave during this time. I think this just layers in the element of AI-generated fake news that is seeping into the overall ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And I believe it's very important that it happens. Recently, there are a couple of instances where politicians were morphed into having a conversation, like an interview with a Chinese channel, CGTN, where the anchor of the TV station is interviewing the ex-prime minister, current senior minister, Lee Hsien Loong, about investment opportunities, and it was totally deepfake. And it was almost like the prime minister was promoting an investment opportunity, right? And they had to come on and clarify that this is not something that has come through authentic sources. This is fake news. Likewise, there have been instances where in Indonesia, the late President Suharto was seen endorsing a couple of candidates during the election. So this is a present and imminent danger for muddling people's views. And I think it is the right time to actually bring this to play. And it's not just the law for the candidates. It's also something that the platforms need to automatically detect and try to take it off. It also is up to individuals when we get videos. We do not broadcast it into chat groups where we are just announcing it. There are distinguishing factors on chat groups, which is private family groups with this publishing groups. So if it's a family group and four of us, my wife, my kids are chatting about it and I share a video, it's considered private and my privacy is protected. But if I'm broadcasting it to a database on my WhatsApp, that's considered as, you know, not legal. So they are trying to bring that to play, so to protect the integrity of elections. I think it is important that policies and laws come into play to mitigate any of these situations.
That's very interesting. I mean, Rachel, I'm interested in your thoughts on this as well, because do you think that it feels like that the bill from the MDDI is helping to bring this situation, this issue to the fore and kind of making, raising awareness across everybody, including just individuals about the prevalence of deepfakes? Do you think that this is important in Singapore? Do you see it being replicated across other markets? Do you think more should be done more generally around deepfakes?
Yeah, I think this is super interesting. I definitely would be supportive of legislative controls and guardrails around anything to do with deepfake AI-generated content and images for all of the reasons that Ranga just mentioned. Although, you know, obviously what you were talking about there, Ranga, was specifically pertaining to images and content used for in and around the election. But I think this is fundamental to our society, right? The proliferation of deepfake AI-generated content is only going to grow, especially if governments don't intervene and do something to try to control how that content is used, made and shared as soon as possible. So I think this is an area of technology development, and if we start to think about it in the context of marketing and advertising, it's an area of content development that needs to be regulated as soon as possible. You know, some would argue we're already sort of shutting the gate after the horse has bolted, because I think perhaps the proliferation of some of this content in certain global markets is telling us that story. And it seems as though a lot of these images are being very popularly shared and produced in APAC markets. You know, one could argue that there has been in popular culture perhaps a higher tolerance of deepfake generated imagery, not for nefarious purposes, for entertainment purposes and for, you know, gaming purposes in that region for a long time. And there's been maybe a higher tolerance of those images in that region than there is in other global regions. And we're now starting to see the impact of that. So I definitely think regulation, we need to get on with that. I think the other thing is, and Ranga mentioned it, I feel very strongly about upholding and protecting the integrity of democracies across the world. And if we don't do enough to make sure that political advertising is accurate, truthful and impartial as to the extent that it can be, obviously a political party wanting to get their messages out there is going to be biased, but the point is they can't be making claims about others and other political parties and other things that are factually inaccurate. So I think the containment and regulation of all of that is absolutely crucial to upholding democratic integrity. So anything that governments need to do to keep that under control has my full support. I was also just looking at this though through a marketing and advertising lens and wondering what the impact of this has on the world of marketing and advertising. So here's a little bit of an angle on my perspective on this. Having said that, I feel very strongly about both of those two elements. I also know that it might not be the case in Singapore, so I'm really interested to hear from you on this, Ranga. But I know that voter turnout is reducing in a lot of democratic countries, and so people feel very disengaged with political discourse and the political system in general in a lot of Western countries in particular. And so I know that political parties and politicians need to do everything they can to get their messages out and to entice people to vote. And so I don't know what the situation there is in Singapore. Love to hear from you on that. But I also wonder then what the impact, you could argue that because these tools are used routinely in the world of marketing and advertising, is the sort of control and regulation of AI in the context of generating content going to slow down innovation? Is it going to impact the ability to get political messages out to a demographic that in Western countries anyway is known for being particularly disenfranchised, and that's young people? So that's the only other angle that I've got to this. But yeah, Ranga, tell us
Rachel, I totally hear, aligned on the fact that we need to protect the institution of democracy, and there are a lot of state and non-state actors who are trying to undermine that, and each country has to do its own to up the guardrails without necessarily disrupting the privacy and the freedom of speech, right? And that balance is a very tough one, and only discourse and having conversation with the society will create that right environment. Now, before I jump back into the advertising opportunity and what happens in that space, a quick point on voter engagement in the country. I think in Singapore, there is still a high degree of engagement amongst all sections of the society to be active participants in the political discourse. And voter turnouts have been reasonably good. And in fact, the government makes it mandatory for people who have who live in the country, who are citizens, to vote. And that kind of becomes a critical part of the voter behavior. Right?
Absolutely.
So a lot of community events, on-ground events happen. But the entire thing is the campaigning is very restricted, very limited time, starts, ends, voted, move on, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of conversation around how well they do it, how ring-fenced it is, etc. But coming back to the idea of voter engagement, it is still pretty high. And people do participate, partly because it's needed. The government mandates, so the constitution mandates that people come and vote, and that drives that engagement as well. When I move to the other part of the conversation around how is deepfake impacting overall commerce or economy in the country, right? A 2023 statistic, if I remember, is about 650 or 700 million Singapore dollars worth of scam money people have lost in the country in just 1 year. That's a huge number.
That's a lot.
Million Sing dollars or 700 million Sing dollars, right? And with the commerce, e-commerce becoming a big part of people's marketers' portfolio of growth, and that's also a platform where a lot of scam happens. So it's important that whatever technology we deploy at scale at an election level is made available to manage the economy as well and protect consumers from deepfake and scam. Of course, there are pure scams that happen from a commerce environment perspective, but there are also situations where people impersonate government officials and dial in and create a conversation. There was a scam that happened in Hong Kong, if you guys paid attention to it, where a global CFO did a reach out to a bank in Hong Kong to say you're transferred $25 million for a secret transaction. And they did a video call just like this. And all of them came on. All the decision makers were on the call, but they are all deep fakes. And they give a go ahead. And this person ended up making the transfer, right?
No.
And then how do you protect? These are all very important on how do you then bring in technologies to actually mitigate. The biggest risk is not for the large corporates because we build our own ring fences, we build our own guardrails. What about the SMEs, MSMEs? They need more technological and regulatory support to actually prevent them from becoming soft targets for such a player. So I believe it's a super important play. But it also gives a little bit of leeway in terms of entertainment. If you're doing it in a way that you're creating original content around it, you're very clearly saying that this is artificial intelligence and it is not real. Those things are important to drive innovation. Those things will help push the conversations forward. And marketers are doing it. Advertisers will do it, and the governments will support it as well. They'll not come in the way. But as long as you're not taking some news and misrepresenting the news using deepfake, it is going to be legit. There's a lot of gray area here, nuances here that one needs to navigate. And a lot of education is required from a consumer education perspective, from working with tech platforms, large global platforms who need to bring their technological heft to ensure that these things are resolved. They deploy that technological heft to do audience profiling, content curation, that they can easily bring that to play in this space. And lastly, regulation will come into play to ensure that anybody who's deviating and creating mischief are very scared of doing it in a market where, you know, you don't tolerate this. So it's across both ends of the spectrum, governance of the country and driving economic agility and vitality, we need to make sure that we have a regulation which protects people from getting scammed, at the same time, does not stifle innovation.
Yeah, I think that's where I find it interesting is the grey areas you mentioned, the kind of the overlap and the fine line between what is digitally manipulated for the purpose of the advert and what is actually being, how it's being used to misrepresent or misinform the average person on the street. And that's where I think it's going to be, it's going to look very, very interesting. And regulation will play a huge, huge role in this. But anyway, I'm going to move us on to our second story. And this comes from the Google blog that they are trying to basically make data privacy simpler for advertisers using confidential matching, which is a new way for advertisers to securely connect their first-party data for Google's measurement and audience solutions. It marks the first use of confidential computing in its ads products. And if confidential computing is another new term for you to get your head around, let me try and help. It is like putting your data into a safe or lockbox while it's being used. So data is normally protected when being stored or sent over the internet, but when it's being processed, that's when it's vulnerable. So confidential computing uses special hardware to keep the data protected when it's being processed, so only the right personal system can actually access it. Obvious use cases here are when processing credit card numbers or passwords. Anyway, back to Google's confidential matching. It is designed to provide protections for advertisers' custom information, as well as transparency into a product's code and the ability to receive proof that data is being processed as intended. As of now, it is the default for any data connections made for customer match, including Google Ads Data Manager. So Rachel, I'm going to come to you first on this one. What do you make of this new privacy feature? I know whenever anything is mentioned with Google, there's often some skepticism from people in the market, certainly when it comes to anything around privacy. But what do you think about this and how it can help advertisers kind of be able to make use of their first party data more effectively?
Well, I think it's quite interesting. I think the timing of it is quite interesting because, of course, Google made their announcement, you know, I can't even remember when now because there's just been so many announcements this year. But let's say, I want to say, yeah, exactly. I want to say at least a month ago, you know, that they wouldn't be deprecating, they wouldn't be taking the decision on deprecating third-party cookies. They would instead put the control for that in the hands of consumers. But they did say that they were going to be persisting with their privacy sandbox testing, and they were going to be continually working on privacy enhancing technologies to improve the way in which brands and advertisers could reach audiences in a Chrome environment. So it's, you know, I think the timing is quite interesting because obviously they made that announcement and then they've carried on with some of the work that they feel is very important to, you know, to achieve some of those goals. So perhaps we shouldn't be surprised about this announcement in and of itself. I thought it was really interesting, similar to you, Lindsay, when I read the release. I wanted to understand a little bit more about confidential computing, what it means and what, you know, what is already out there in the world that we're using that is built and controlled by confidential computing. Came up with the exact same information as you. They mentioned, of course, that it makes use of, and they said this in the release as well, something known as trusted execution environments or TEE environments.
Yes.
And it's that environment that isolates business information while it's being processed. So as you said, Lindsay, confidential computing is about the processing of the information. Because at first I sort of read this and thought, are we talking about a data clean room here? Is this just Google's version of a data
Same.
Clean room?
Mm-hmm.
But I don't. Even though there are some similar features, they are two distinctly different things, and I think they are also two distinctly different tools that contribute towards more privacy-enhancing technologies for brands and advertisers that want to use and apply their first-party data, want to execute on that data. So this is something different. I think that it can only be a good thing for any brands and advertisers that want to reach audiences in a secure way in a Chrome environment. And I also think what's interesting about this is that IB Tech Labs have come out in support of it because, of course, they're strong advocates of privacy-enhancing technology. Google have already said that they're going to be making their sort of architecture on which they've built their trusted execution environment using confidential computing, so many terms there, but they've said they're going to make that architecture, share that architecture and make it available so that others can be building confidential solutions on top of this. So it all sounds to me very sort of open source, you know, an encouraging start to making a suite of tools available to brands and advertisers that are moving around and trying to execute campaigns in a Chrome environment. Good. That all to me sounds like good news. The degree to which it changes the overall landscape of how useful it is to move, you know, to execute your campaigns in that Chrome environment is a whole other matter. I don't think it's necessarily going to mean that brands and marketers are reaching more audiences there. I think this is just really a mechanism to ensure that they can be privacy compliant about the audiences that they are reaching in that environment. That would be my summary position. And also, it's obviously going to require some testing, although, like you said, Lindsay, it's not like they're sort of rolling it out. And I'm sure they'd make some amends to it or enhancements to it along the way, but it's basically going to be the default option now in Google Yes. Ads Manager. The proof will be in the pudding. And I guess the other question is, to what extent will it give brands and marketers more confidence that the data that they're contributing to, the first-party data that they might be bringing to this marketing and advertising transaction is being properly handled and dealt with? And I'm sure it will improve that level of confidence.
Absolutely. Very comprehensive answer there. Thank you, Rachel. Ranga, you probably have nothing more to add now because Rachel said it all. But what do you make
unlikely,
of this?
Unlikely.
What do you make of this new feature, Ranga? How do you think it will help, you know, you as an agency and help your clients in terms of how they can safely and privately use their first-party data?
I'm going to use a Formula One analogy here, you know.
Great.
Brilliant.
The data clean rooms for me are Ferraris. Mm. Or maybe it's a McLaren of today, right? We have that... very, very superiorly built vehicles where we are able to do multiple analysis. You bring multiple data sets in, and it is not just one or two data sets. Like in this case, confidential computing, it is client data, Google data, and trying to figure out the overlaps and just use the overlap without leaking the rest of the data, right? And either Google enhancing itself. It's almost like Google trying to come up clean to say, I'm not taking your data and making myself rich, right? It's also there. Now, if you look at clean rooms, they allow us to do multiple things, and we can do deep dive and still keep the data integrity. Now, this confidential computing, confidential matching will allow for more mid to long tail marketers to come on board on sharing their own CRM data to unlock better targeting, creating better user experiences, and better ROI for their marketing dollars. I think that for me is magic. Large advertisers still want to run the Ferraris to make sure that they're not exposed. Imagine the, you know, violation on data privacy and you're exposed to about 2% of your global revenues. The mid to small marketers are scared and they don't want to touch that. They say, okay, I don't have the legal counsel. I don't have this, capability to judge if I'm actually going to, violate the data agreement that I have with my customers. So I might just go with something that's less personalized, but not expose themselves to that. To me, I think it opens up that set of clients who will be very scared of doing anything, sharing their CRM, and they're protected because they don't know what else to do and they don't have the capability nor the budgets to do a clean room kind of a solution. The large marketers will still go and pursue a bespoke solution. They probably use confidential matching with whatever they are building and enhance what they do. So I think it's a good thing. And from Google's perspective, as well as marketers, the mid to long tail businesses to actually come on board and start unlocking the value of personalization and still protecting the consumer interest.
Mm. That's very interesting. I hadn't considered it from the mid to long tail and that is what Google as a business generally is all about. Like what they're doing
Absolutely.
Is building, you know, that's where the most of revenue comes from. Anything they can do to open up this new opportunity for those kind of small to medium sized businesses is going to be probably quids in for them. It's very interesting.
And do you think then, I mean, that's really, likewise, Lindsay, I didn't think about it from that perspective. So that's super interesting, Ranga. But do you also think that means that there'll be some, small to mid-size advertisers that will then be more encouraged to spend more of their budget and time in Google in a Google environment than they already do? Because yet again, this is a solution that's making it easy for those size brands to just go with the Google stack. Because look, we can also take care of all of this. We can make sure that we're looking after your data and promise you that everything's going to be get okay.
I think it is. And if you look at what Facebook did, what Meta did a while ago, what custom audiences, you take your personal audience. Also in this part of the world, they take shopper data from e-commerce sites and then try to target them through, you know, Facebook Insights. They've been doing that. But Google has come up and said how they are doing it in a much more
transparent way.
Transparent way, more kosher way from a business perspective. So I think I believe Facebook has unlocked that through that kind of partnership, taking customer data, custom audiences, and building from there, and gained some momentum on ad dollars. And I think confidential matching allows Google to have the same play with their own AI solutions also activating against these insights, right? So I think it will unlock more revenues. I think they've already garnered between these two walled gardens, already garnered a pretty sizable amount of mid to long tail businesses. So I don't know how much more they can pull out, but I'm optimistic for the advertisers as much as I feel glad that Google has come forward and done something like this after a bit.
And I mean, the sort of feedback that we hear often from advertisers in this region and also in APAC is that they now no longer want to invest all of their money in one type of environment and one type of advertising stack anyway, even the SME size clients. So, you know, maybe you're right, Ranga. Maybe, you know, although it does sound like it gives Google an opportunity to claw more budget from that side, you know, that part of the market, maybe we are at a point in, you know, the advertising market's history where actually the mentality from a lot of marketers is, hang on a minute, I do want to spread my bets a bit. So this is good. This will be really useful for one type of advertising and for trying to reach a particular kind of audience, but I also need to be spending money elsewhere as well. I don't know.
Yeah, totally. See, the more the organized part of the business, the long, the head of the business, the networks, etc. And the large clients, global clients, they want to keep it efficient. They want to keep it as less complicated as possible, as simple as possible. So they typically tend to minimize the number of partners that they are, and they try to extract more value from each partner. But the folks who are more constrained with their budget, who want to get maximum bang for their buck, they will do a lot of test and runs and then bet on the ones that are giving them better ROI. So I think plays right at the strength of Google's current revenue streams and revenue ecosystem, which I also believe they want to further unlock, given the headwinds that they will face from people moving out of search, Google search, to other search ecosystems, whether it is on-site shopping, inside social ecosystem searching, so on and so forth. This is a way they can mitigate revenue loss from the mid to long tail business.
Yeah. Interesting.
Speaking of unlocking revenues, or maybe the opposite, I'm not sure, our next story, which comes from Video Week, shows that the UK trade body ISBAR is pushing for financial audits to become commonplace in programmatic. So in 2022, it released a programmatic financial audit toolkit, which was designed to help advertisers run their own audits in a standardised way. Last week, it released an update to these tools, which include a letter which advertisers can send to vendors asking for log-level data, guidelines on how this data should be provided, and guidelines on how it can be used. ISBAR hopes that these tools will make programmatic financial transactions a more routine part of running programmatic campaigns. This toolkit came off the back of the study carried out by ISBAR and PwC, again back around in 2022, start of COVID, I think that's when, yeah, I remember we
2020,
had
2020, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, because we had it's the start of our virtual podcasts, which have remained ever since. But around that time, it aimed to understand that the average programmatic supply chain looked like and how much of an advertiser's spend ended up in different parts of that chain. One of the biggest takeaways from this study was actually how challenging it was to run the study in the first place, to actually be able to audit these companies. And they found that many vendors didn't provide log-level data, and those that did, it was not standardised in any way. So it obviously made life very, very difficult for them running the study and, of course, for advertisers requesting this data. The study was then rerun last year with great improvements in processes and outcomes, and the purpose of the updated toolkit is to allow advertisers to bring the auditability of programmatic ad spend in line with other media channels. So Ranga, I'm going to come to you and get your thoughts first on this. obviously this is a UK-based study and UK-based toolkit, but surely these kinds of approaches are really helpful to advertisers and agencies globally to enable them to be able to audit the financial viability of programmatic ad spend.
I think it's super important, but I'd like to go on a bit of a time travel to when the first publication of this report happened. And they basically said close to the 50% of the throughput was not being able to be, was not matched. And that actually caused a lot of flutter in the industry. And people who were naysayers to programmatic walked away and started going into walled gardens. They were more than happy to be in a black box environment where they didn't know what's happening than be in an environment that was a bit of a wild, wild west, wild, wild east, whatever you call it. Right. But then the claw back into that programmatic space has been pretty slow. And I don't think the second report that came up, which said it's come now, the delta is now 3%, never got enough airtime. So there was a lot of, people using the report for their own benefit. And it impacted the open exchange quite a bit. And I think now with both in terms of speed of audit, as well as the record matching improvement, as well as a guideline for organizations, how do you go about auditing, right? I'll give you a framework. These are the 10 steps. These are the things you need to do. You got to run a campaign. You got to name your campaigns this way so that you're auditable, makes this a very, very valuable toolkit for every advertiser. And I would recommend everybody to do it. I don't just want to stop it at Open Exchange. And programmatic, I want this to go into the walled garden environments as well. You know, why should we restrict it to a bunch of players who are more disorganized and we have a lot of option, but we don't put the same standards to where vast majority of your digital spends are going. So today, I think we need to have an equal measure across all platforms, both programmatic as well as the walled gardens to ensure that there is a fair play. One of the big opportunities is how do we look at overall ad impressions and audit trail of that through my entire digital investment. We are expecting, we are already looking at about 70% of our total spends being in digital, right? And of that, today, between Meta, Alphabet, and ByteDance, they're probably accounting for more than 50% of the ad dollars. How do we then bring that into play is something that we need to seriously consider. I'm super excited, and accountability, I believe, will add significant value to any business. If you're holding yourself accountable with third-party audit tools, you're going to make yourself more accountable. But just make sure the upsides, the positive news that comes from here is also put out there for the marketers to hear. And not just on scary number, 50%, and everybody walked away. And now everybody's very careful about coming back into this space, right? So we need to balance this. That's my thought, yeah.
Absolutely.
And so many good points there.
Yeah, Ranga raised some great points there, especially around the fact that, you know, we're very good at shouting about bad news stories in the industry and not so good at shouting about the when the positive things happen. What do you think the importance of financial auditability is for advertising agencies? And does this tool kind of help overcome some of those challenges?
Yeah, I think it's hugely important for a lot of the reasons that Ranga stated. I think it really adds credibility, basically, to your business. So I think the concepts of an audit of your advertising spend doesn't just benefit the brand or the advertiser to understand where that spend's going. It also fundamentally benefits the technology platforms and anyone that's in that value chain. So whether we're talking about programmatic spend or whether, as Ranga's ambition is, if we're talking about just advertising investment across the piece, I think it's a really important tool because it basically pulls everything out into the open and gives legitimacy to every person's business model. And we can start talking about that in much more of an open and transparent way. I think it is, you know, somewhat, I will be more controversial in my views here, but I think it is somewhat criminal that it isn't applied to the walled garden environments. I can only imagine what would happen if brands and advertisers and their agency, you know, colleagues tried to pressure those technology suppliers to adhere adhere to audit standards, I'm sure that those walled gardens would organise themselves very well internally to come up with lots of really good believable reasons as to why they didn't need to audit themselves in that way. They could instead perhaps just audit themselves in the way that they've already been auditing themselves. But again, I hope that we are coming to a point in the history of the advertising industry where those answers will no longer be accepted by brands and advertisers. You know, Google is very much under the microscope for its anti-competition behavior concerning not just its search engine, but also its ad stack. I would like to see there being much more of a prominent conversation from the likes of industry bodies such as ISBA, but also the WFA and other international advertiser bodies going to those technology platforms and saying, look, we've got a standard, an audit standard that's worked really well here in the open marketplace. Let's look at what's happening in your marketplace and have those conversations at a very serious senior level, because, you know, it's about time. And I think it would just change so many things about the advertising marketplace. And probably all of those changes are not going to be welcomed by all sorts of corners of the industry, right? There'll be things that won't necessarily, you know, there are certainly things that the walled garden operators are keen to keep in their black boxes, but there'll also be inconvenient truths that come out for others along the way too, not just the technology providers, but also the agencies and also the brands and the advertisers. But if we are really going to, you know, we talk a lot in this industry about changing the value proposition between consumer and advertising. And if we're really serious about doing that sort of stuff, we need to start behaving like a serious grown-up adult industry and apply some discipline and some, you know, some useful business principles to the way that we're transacting advertising and marketing, in my opinion.
And aside from the obvious challenges that you've both mentioned when it comes to the walled gardens and the auditability of the walled gardens in this, you know, this toolkit, obviously, because it's been released by ISBA, who work exclusively with advertisers, it places the burden of the auditing onto the advertiser. What kind of hurdles are they going to face? Like, what are the responsibilities and roles of the tech vendors and the agencies in this as well? How can they help the advertiser ensure that they are able to not just take this framework and go, well, I don't know what to do with this, I don't know how to implement this? Are there roles that the agencies and the vendors play in this process too?
Totally, Lindsay. I mean, agencies have been doing this in one form or the other across all touch points, right? We have a strong accountability team. We have a commitment on outcomes for the clients, and we hold ourselves accountable through third-party audits, client audits, internal audits to make sure that what we commit, we deliver. Most of those auditable measures are typically outcome-based, right? And maybe in some cases there are CPRP-based, which is still an input variable. So things do go through a rigor and a framework in most of the network agencies, I would say. And there are also auditors who are specialists in media auditing who come in and help facilitate that process to bring a neutral view. I think the challenge is when this kind of audit becomes too much of a witch hunt to say what is going on, where can I pull more levers, and how do I bring this number down? This $101 becomes 70 because I'm optimizing a supply path. While you do that, you don't lose focus on your outcome. You are there to bring a lead. You are there to drive attention. You drive to bring a reach. And what is the most efficient way of bringing that reach still is the true north. These are intermediary variables you're optimizing to get there. And transparency and visibility and trust in that intermediary variables allows us to get to the end goal. So we can't lose track of that. But I'm just worried the risk of auditing too much of the supply path is to forgetting why are we doing this to start with. I want to get a sale. I want to get an attention. I want to get an audience to look at my ad. And am I doing it in an efficient way at a dollar price? Then why not? Right? Then I think you need to give yourself a little bit of leeway on that. But balancing it also becomes an important part between what you're trying to achieve and what is the ingredients that are going into it. Yeah, you're not going to judge a soup by how did the chef put the ingredients in. You're going to measure it based on how much you paid and how tasty it was. So let's keep to the basics.
Yeah, it's so true. We've heard the analogy lots of times, you know, around building a car. Like, I don't need to know every single component part that goes into the car. I don't need to inspect all of it. I just need to know that it works as a car. And I remember speaking to agencies many years ago, you know, before, long before all this kind of this study was released, and them saying, the advertiser will ask me for log files. And I'll go, sure, here you go. Here's all the log files. And they go, okay, well, what do I do with this? What is this? It's like, well, you asked for it. Like, what am I supposed to, I can't now, and it's exactly that point, isn't it? Like, don't let it lose focus on what the actual outcome of this campaign or this, you know, of our work together is. Rachel, you know, what's your perspective on, can this get in the way sometimes of actually us affecting our working relationship and us doing great advertising together?
Well, I mean, I was thinking about sort of what had happened, the journey that the industry has taken since the release of the initial report, which, as you said, both of you, Lindsay and Ranga, talked about how you know, how controversial the findings were at the time and how much heat and attention the report attracted. So if we look at that to then the interim report or the second report, which showed that unknown delta had reduced significantly, and then have a look at what ISPA has just recently produced with their sort of audit standard and a kind of a template that brands and advertisers can use to approach that audit process, that already is a huge amount of progress in a short period of time. And I think some of that will be down to the first audit probably caught a lot of people sort of unawares. I'm not going to say by surprise, but more just unaware. Oh, okay, I didn't really realise me producing these data log files in this format was totally useless to anyone else that wanted to look at it except for me. So I think it will have had the benefit of standardising some things, making it easier for tech providers to produce useful information or summarised information so that the people that are looking at that information aren't wasting their whole lives looking through stuff that's not going to be relevant or important. I think it will also have standardised the way that brands and agencies are working together on their advertising spend so that they can better understand how to conduct an audit process in a meaningful way. And I think, therefore, given the sort of reduction in that unknown delta, which we could argue therefore, because there was such a reduction from first report to second report, a lot of it was probably to do with processes and standardisation. People didn't really, you know, weren't working in the most efficient way possible just to produce the information. So given the positive trajectory there, I feel pretty strongly that the principle is right, what you've both mentioned. We don't want to audit for audit's sake, and we don't want to distract ourselves from getting on with the transaction, which is the most valuable thing. But I think it's about just instilling some discipline and some expectations. It's professionalising the industry and professionalising this part of the industry. Like Ranga said, agencies are already very well versed in dealing with audits and audit trails. They are big, sophisticated organisations, even small independent agencies. They are based on a business model that is known and understood and, you know, has all those usual financial disciplines applied to it. Same for brands and agencies. We just need to bring all of that discipline and all of that intelligence to the transaction. And, you know, I suppose therefore not surprising that we started with looking at programmatic supply chain, because programmatic is a new technology and a new tool. Let's just professionalize it. And I'm sure that we'll see that we're getting to the heart of what's needed rather than distracting ourselves with unnecessary data and information.
Now, just weighing in on that, right? I think some of these issues are also driven by some big names and audit companies, right? I have had conversations with senior clients where their consulting, big five consultants, go in and say, reduce non-working media. And they'll come and say, what is non-working media? Is ad, tagging your ad copy, is it non-working because it's not building reach? No, it's verifying that you're buying reach. So you should be investing in ad verification tools. Oh, but my consultant says, don't do that. And it's kind of silly trying to optimize things that you don't even understand. So we as a stakeholder should have a very strong point of view and push back and say, don't come up with these bullshit comments if you don't know what you're talking about, just because you have the pedestal to sit on and, you know, pontificate. So it's our responsibility also to stand tall and push back and create the right narrative out there so people understand what we're trying to do. And it is complex, right? And to Rachel's your point earlier, first, the data was all over the place. And we've figured out how to normalize the data. We've figured out how to structure the data. We've then given a framework for people to run their data ecosystem in that way. So when somebody wants to look at it, it is a consistent way of looking. So it's, I think this is a great initiative. We all should embrace it. And even though it is a UK audit and UK, it's universally true and universally applicable. So very much welcome this. And we should educate our respective stakeholders and our respective geographies to move forward in this space.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And, you know, I think that is a point well made. Everything was all a little messy to start with when the first of these audits, you know, were taking place. Let's not get lost in management consultancy speak and initiatives. Let's just create a practical sort of audit profile for the industry. And I think as a group of professionals, we should be able to do that. And, yeah, let's get ISPA speaking at ATS Singapore next year. They need an international chapter.
They certainly do. On that note, I'm going to end. Thank you so much, Rachel. Thank you so much, Ranga. Really, really good discussion. Before we go, I'm just going to remind everybody that the WIRES, our awards program, the WIRES shortlist is released today, the release of this podcast. And a reminder also to vote for ATIP Personality and ATIP Rising Star, the shortlist. You'll find it all on exchangewire.com/awards. But thank you, Ranga. Thank you, Rachel. Thanks, everyone, for listening.